kids are just, their brains are amazing. They just know what to do.
She just wanted to feel connected to me, you know, like, and that's what would be the most helpful.
I'm all about supporting parents. You know, they're their child's first and best teachers.
And, you know, it was for me that moment of like, ooh, I failed them. But I was like, oh, no, I'm actually unlocking something really beautiful here.
That I'm reminding myself is so crucial to meeting my kids' needs, meeting my needs.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Sensory Play Reimagined, a podcast exploring how sensory play can help unlock your child's development and well-being potential. I'm your host, Rachel Rothman. I'm a mom of three. I'm a toy expert, and I am thrilled to have with us today Maggie. Maggie is a learning specialist. She has a master's degree in childhood education, a certificate in special education, and just a wealth of experience supporting children's educational journeys through everything that she's done for the last 15 plus years. So Maggie, I am so thrilled to have you. And maybe before we dive in, you can give a little bit more context on who you are, what you're doing now, before we kind of dive into everything.
Awesome. Thank you. And I'll start, honestly, I'm so excited to be here. So thank you for having me. Rachel, you and I share so many of the same passions. So I don't know if I'm more excited to just be talking to you, but also, or if I'm
excited
to be on this amazing platform, for these products that I've used in my classroom, like, and have in my home for EduShape. So really thrilled. So as you said, learning specialist, ADHD coach, mama two. I would say that my focus is really just, you know, working with students and families and, you know, really giving them support and empowering, you know, them to find systems and routines and approaches that really work best for them. I'm all about supporting parents. You know, they're their child's first and best teachers. So to me, you know, that's really where my heart is right now. And even though I do have a background in literacy and all of that, I'm really just loving this space of thinking about play and parenting and how we learn through all of that.
I love that. And I love how you said we are their first and kind of their most profound teacher in everything that we're doing. And it's not a job I take lightly. I know it's not one you take lightly. And, you know, it's tough. You know, it can be really challenging. So I applaud you on the work that you're doing. And I'm excited to extract some of your knowledge and share it with everybody, because I know it's been incredibly useful for me. Anytime I talk to you, I walk away with ideas and I feel, you know, rejuvenated and regenerized. And it's not like in this way that feels so, you know, sometimes it just feels like too much. Talk a little bit more just about summer, if we can focus, you know, a little bit more granularly in there, because we are off for summertime. It can be overwhelming for both the parents and for the kids. You know, maybe we can talk a little bit about just like the setting and the context of the time and space that we're in right now. Like, to you, what does summer mean kind of in like the biggest sense as it relates to kids?
Yeah. I love the summertime. I love this topic because to me, for kids, at least in most cases, that academic pressure is not really in their life typically, right? Not the way that it is during the school year. And there's also more opportunity for boredom. And I'm all about boredom. It leads to creativity. It lets kids' brains relax. It really gives them the time to sort of explore at their own pace. And in some cases that's uncomfortable for some kids, but there is more opportunity.
And grown-ups.
What's that?
Is that, and some grown-ups? You know,
absolutely.
I feel like, I know myself sometimes, even knowing that it's good for them, you know, we see, you know, people doing so much. And sometimes it's like, you know, I had to remind myself, even just this weekend, we were at the beach and my kids were asking like, oh, you know, like, we don't have our shovel. We didn't bring shovel. We just like kind of spontaneously went to the beach and we didn't have shovels and we didn't have like a lot of stuff with us. And at first they were like, well, what are we going to do? And I'm like, I don't know. What do you think we can do? You know, and at first I was kind of like, oh, no, I didn't have all this stuff. And, you know, my oldest daughter was like, oh, well, we could use our hands as scoopers. And, you know, my son's like, I'm going to go and pick up some rocks to decorate. And, you know, like they were so creative in what they came up with. And, you know, it was for me that moment of like, ooh, I failed them. But I was like, oh, no, I'm actually unlocking something really beautiful here. So I think it's, you know, not just the kid pressures, but also, you know, the parental pressures of creating kind of these like situations that feel perfect, but that in fact are actually removing a lot of the educational and developmental opportunities for kids. So
absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll echo that too, to say that I feel like some of my favorite memories already of the summer were not so much the ones that I planned, but the ones that were sort of unplanned, or that maybe we had plans and they were canceled, and then I'm trying to figure out something to do with them and we end up just not doing much at all. I can't tell you how many times my kids have just run out into the rainstorm. We've had so many rainstorms with us that just that summer, you can't beat that summer rain. And yeah. And to me, that's the type of play that I'm reminding myself is so crucial to meeting my kids' needs, meeting my needs, and reducing, like you said, that kind of pressure to like have something sort of planned at every moment, because kids are just, their brains are amazing. They just know what to do in those scenarios. It may take some kids a little bit more time, or maybe they need a little scaffolding to get there. But in most cases, I say that they usually surprise us with, their amazing creativity.
Yeah. I will say, I know that we both have, you know, kids who love to get outside, be active, et cetera. What is there kind of like, again, before we kind of dive into everything, but just even getting them outside, do you have any advice for parents who like that might be a little bit of a struggle to get the kids outside? Like, what's your kind of framework for motivating and or incentivizing and or just facilitating getting kids outside to start with?
Yeah, I mean, I think you'll probably hear me say this quite often. I think it's reducing the pressure and also making or framing like getting outside is, you know, I hear a lot of times it's like, oh, I just want to like get my kids outside and like, you know, get them away from, you know, I need a little space, that type of thing. But I think if we engage in play outside, they sort of follow our lead. So typically, if it's a little bit of a struggle, I usually make it seem like it's something I need to do. There's something I have to do outside. And I'm like, oh, could, you know, I might need to do a little help in the garden, or this summer, you know, our kind of thing was a summer garden with vegetables and things like that. And in no way does it look pretty right now, but they've loved it. And so sometimes, you know, if they're kind of resistant to that, I'll kind of give them a job. I'd be like, you know, I just like really need to check on those tomatoes. Those yesterday, those tomatoes like were green and I wanted to make a salad. And, you know, do you think you could help me? And I think sometimes when we sort of shift the power dynamic there, then it's a little bit less pressure on them to be like, I need to just, you know, have this big world out there that could feel a little bit like overwhelming. They're not sure what to do next. So sort of following my lead, I guess, is the way that I would go about that.
It's funny. Somebody framed it for me in a way that like really resonated. It was one of my children's educators of kind of like that transition time of like getting them from inside to go outside. And exactly as you just described, like giving a job. So all of my kids always get, you know, jobs, and then they feel like it empowers them. So then they become, one of them becomes the door holder even, you know, like, and she takes this job very seriously. And then, you know, like almost like to a place where I'm like, all right, we, you know, doors, you know, many people have gone through now, we're good to go. But just like the idea, like you said, of giving them agency, of giving them a task, of making them feel like they're, you know, they're actively supporting whatever it is, you know, kind of in the grander mission. But yeah, so we have a door holder. I have one who we likewise have a not so pretty garden, but like the kids love it. And, you know, it's also an opportunity for them to get their hands dirty and to learn about, you know, having a variety of fruits. Like there's so many things that they're unpacking by doing that. And just reminding myself like that in and of itself is such a beautiful gift that we're giving them. You know, they're learning about food and nutrition and plants and, you know, biology, and they're getting outside and they're being active and they're doing physicality and all these different things. So I love that. And I love that you've started a garden, and we've done it now the last 3 years, and this is definitively our ugliest. And let me tell you, our kids are the most engaged this year. So it does not need to be pretty. It does not need to be perfect. But you know, it is, and we've actually like created like a routine and a tradition with it. So they get excited, you know, every year around the same time to do it. So it's something that they can look forward to. So I look forward to that for you as well. Enjoying that. Okay, so diving in, sensory play, outside, you know, do you have any examples or ideas that you can share with ways that we can get kids engaged with, you know, nature? We talked about kind of going to the beach. Are there other things that you do either in your own home or that you make recommendations for the families that you're working with for kind of making outside more engaging, inviting, playful, et cetera?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, to me, sensory play can and a lot of you should be really simple. I say let them get dirty. I let them get dirty. If there's any chance you can find water, whether you're bringing a bucket of water outside, playing with the garden hose, filling up a kiddie pool, water is very regulating for some kids. So something like that. I mean, really just keep it, throwing some ice cubes in there. I really do keep it simple when it comes to that outdoor play. There's two things that come to mind, though, that I seem to get a lot of responses from parents that say, like, wow, this is kind of like a magic like sauce here. But one is like if I go outside and I busy myself with something. So, for example, putzing around the garden, or if I start like organizing the garage, I notice my kids will then take it upon themselves to find things that are interesting to them. They'll sort of wander. One of my kids will go on the swings. Maybe the other one's, you know, I have a 2-year-old, so he's playing with ants and squishing them in his fingers, like whatever it is. But they sort of do
my
that.
My daughter development. It's good. It's good.
It's great. I love it. But like if I'm just standing there, like sort of available to them, I guess is what I'm saying, is that they sort of look to me to direct them. So I just noticed that if I sort of like shift my direction sort of somewhere else, it encourages them to maybe like feel like they're less on a stage or something. I don't know what it is, but, in most cases, you know, I have parents who are like, oh my God, yeah. Like the second I start vacuuming, that's when my kids start playing with each other. So that's my like one big, you know, bit. If you feel like your kids are kind of just like looking for your direction and you really want them to like sort of find that intrinsic motivation or, you know, engage in their own interests, but they need a little support, I say kind of like get yourself a little busy doing something else.
I love that. I love that. And so
and
true.
And secondly, like I would say, if you're looking for that moment to play with your child and engage in that sensory play, is like really allowing it to be child-led. I think we also kind of feel a lot of pressure to be like, oh, look at this, or let's play with this water. But rather than sort of switching the, like who's kind of leading the play there and just being more of the observer rather than the like facilitator of the play. So what this could kind of look like is, you know, you see your child sort of like walk towards the pool, like a little kiddie pool or even the dirt, whatever it is. My kids love to rip up our mulch, even though we pay so much money for landscaping. There's something about the mulch. So like, you know, if I were to allow them to be child-led in that sense, I might just be looking, watching, seeing what my 2-year-old is, you know, observing. And then, you know, he picks something up and holds it to me. And I say, oh, what is that? Where are you going to put that? You know, more question oriented, just to kind of let them lead what he wants to do. And he's really not, you know, I'm not sitting there saying like, oh, why don't we play with this ball? Or why don't we ride on the bike? But more of like just sort of being engaged in what he's doing, being interested in what he's doing, maybe even just narrating what he's doing and saying, oh, you put the mulch on your legs. Is it itchy? Because I see him wiping it away. And then he kind of like does it to me. And I just go, oh, that feels so itchy. And so sort of just putting some language to what they're doing, but really kind of letting them take the lead there.
I love that. So many things I want to unpack with that. And I just, at the last thing that you said, it's funny, like, that's been very hard for me as a parent. Like, I know that that's not one of my best skills. It's like, I do want to kind of jump in and I'm like, no, remind yourself, you know, take a pause. And so a lot of times now I'll parrot back. Like if they ask me a question, I'll ask it back to them in like an inquisitive way.
That.
So like my son this morning was like, you know, why does, I fill in the blank, you know, it was a why question. And I asked him, I said, well, why do you think? And, you know, it gave him that moment of pause. And then he started to, you know, like, so for me, as simple as, like, again, it's something that I had to like teach myself to do, but parroting back whatever questions they have, you know, I have this desire to like want to give them all the knowledge I have. And I'm like, no, let them figure it out. Let them come up with ideas. Let them work through it, because that's how they'll, you know, kind of create that foundation of understanding and being inquisitive and being creative. So I do the parrot back a lot with the questions that you were describing, and then also kind of just like the narration of just like, I am an observer, I am seeing it and calling, you know, attention to whatever is happening. And it's funny for my different kids, like different senses for them are kind of stronger. So like for one, I may be like, you know, how does that feel on your body? She's someone who does not like tactile experiences. So like I'll bring awareness to that for her. And I'll be like, you know, how does that feel? Does it feel rough? Does it feel soft? So that she's starting to build like the understanding of what feels good and what doesn't for her. And then, you know, again, depending upon kind of who my kids are, I've shared on the podcast before, like they all have different sensory profiles. So like depending upon who they are and what they're kind of attuned to, kind of drawing attention to that. But and I know that we have talked about this before, but like bringing it out through the senses, you know, how does it feel? How does it smell? You know, bringing it out through all of them, et cetera, I think is something that's really powerful, and it helps them, you know, again, observe and take in more and understand things better. And I did want to just say before we jump, that the ice has been magical this summer for us.
It's amazing. I don't know what it is about the
ice. I mean, we actually bought like a $5 jug thing that we leave outside for water play outside. So my kids have access to it on their own, that they can like do it. And I'm like, worst thing, something gets wet, it's going to dry outside, all good. But we've actually brought ice, not just outside, but also into bath. So our kids have been way more resistant to bath with like all of the transitions and everything that's going on, like during summer, no more school now and camp or all the things that are happening that are changing. And so we brought ice into bath, and it has been like the one thing that gets my kids into the bath. So I had one who was like refusing, and I'm like, do you think if we add more ice, you know, like what do you think is going to happen? And I kid you not, last night, I mean, my husband wasn't too happy. Unloaded the entire ice box, but like one, it was like it gave them a job, it gave them a task, it was a different sensory experience, it was like all the different things that it was so positive for, but like ice in the bath. So if anyone is having trouble this summer with bath time, ice in the bath has been very, very helpful.
You know, it's a good one too, Epsom salts. There's something about the Epsom salts that my kids love to like rub in their fingers. And it's something that you can put in the bath that, you know, if you get like one with lavender smell or something, it's like a little relaxing.
Yeah.
And that kind of happened really organically for us. We're not big bath people, but, you know, my husband had like an injury, so he was using it. And then my kids like discovered it in the bathroom. We all share the same bath. We only have one bathtub in the whole house. So, you know, then they started throwing it in the water, and I'm like, wait, this is great. Go for it. But I wanted to circle back to just, you know, that child-led and you describing how like we're kind of like also putting like that naming of the sensory, but I love to also put language of advocacy there, because like you said, your kids have very different needs, so do mine. I have one kid who loves to get dirty. I have the other kid who does not like to get dirty. And so, you know, narrating what those sensory feelings are that you let, you, I always like to give them the language of, do you like that? Does that feel good to you? Oh, you don't like that. Your face is telling me you don't like that. You know, even my two-year-old still trying to like learn to, you know, put sentences together. So it's like, I don't like that. It's like, okay. So then next time, if you feel something, you can say, I don't like that. And I think giving them the language for self-advocacy is also really, really empowering for them, to not just learn what they're feeling and engaging in them in their sensory that way, but also giving them some communication tools there as well.
I love that. Yeah. Is there a particular EduShape product that comes to mind that as either a parent and or in the classroom that, you know, you kind of go to time and time again, or a favorite?
Yeah. I'm actually not sure what they're called, but they're the sensory balls that have like the little spikes on them.
That's it. The original sensory ball.
Yeah. I have never, if I didn't have them in my classroom, I ordered them. I paid with my own money. Nothing is like, kids gravitate towards them. They like to watch them float. It's funny because I even like when they deflate a little bit, because sometimes over time they get like a little bit squishier. Like, I just noticed that the kids just like to hold on to it. They like to throw it in the bath. We've got at least 5 of them in our play pool outside. There's just something about them that they just always love to play with. And we'll have them in this household forever and ever. I'll also say that I do in-person sessions for some students that I work with. And I always have them in my bag because I notice sometimes if they're feeling like a little bit fidgety or uncomfortable, I go, oh, could you just hold on to this for me? And they won't let that thing go the entire session. So.
Oh, I love that. I love that. Yeah, we have countless ones in our house and also different sizes too. And it's funny, like we were just describing like what are great open-ended toys. Like the number of things my kids can do with these balls is impressive yeah. Even to me. And it was funny with the little ones, my daughter had brought it over, like she was doing paint. And at first I was like, and then I was like, oh, let's see where this goes. And she wound up painting with them, and it came into like this really cool kind of like drawing. And then I was like, oh, and then I started making modifications to it. And I like threw it in a bin with some paint, and they were, like giving them kind of more, tools around it. But, I would not have thought the sensory balls plus art would have been like this synergistic moment for my daughter. And, no shocker here, she's a sensory seeker, so like the combination of the ball and the feelings that she was getting with it combined with the pain combined with like this like creative artistic expression was just like a very happy place for her. So yes, I think it's like beyond just like the tactile and the different sensations that they're getting from it and feeling like giving purpose to their hands that might be fidgety or all those other things, but art, who knew? And she that was something that she was really enjoying too. We were talking also about one of the big things that you're doing in terms of like supporting families, particularly those who have neurodivergence, is helping to support executive function. And I think that might be a new word for a lot of people who are listening. Do you mind walking through what is executive function? What does that mean? And then maybe we can go through some examples how, even with the examples you were just giving, you're actually helping to support that.
Yeah. So executive functioning, the way that I kind of really boil it down for both parents and kids is, to me, I call them the learning to learn skills, or learning to get things done skills, I guess, is one way of putting it. But it's really essentially something that we kind of all develop at a different pace. Neurodivergent learners tend to be, a few years kind of behind in developing some of those executive function skills. And this can be, I think we hear this term a lot. A lot of people assume or think, organization, studying, binders, things like that, but it can also be self-regulation. It can be self-initiation, kind of being goal-oriented, and like I said, those getting things done skills. And right now, I think this is a great time to be talking about this, because a lot of research is really showing us that literally the best way to develop executive functioning skills is free and open play, especially Yay. In their most critical developing years. But even as, young kids and adults, we kind of need that space to develop these skills. So I think, kids who are like free playing and they're playing with their friends or they're playing even by themselves, to us, it may not seem like they're developing executive function skills explicitly, but even something like remembering the rules of a game, right, is building their working memory, or
even devising the rules of a game.
Or even like, devising the rules of the game. Or like we've seen kids make up games and, they're sort of changing the rules as they go along. To me, that's the mental, we call that cognitive flexibility that they're really working on. And then self-control is an aspect of executive functioning and that part of our brain. When kids attend to rules or they're making their actions goal-oriented, they want to like build a sandcastle. Those are all executive function skills that are being worked on and developed right before our eyes without it being explicitly taught to them. So I'm just so grateful that we have information now to really prove that, because the advocacy here in most cases, I think parents are looking for me to be like, give me strategy, give me this. And in a lot of cases, yes, we can set up a home environment that's like very conducive to the way that their child's brain is and how their brains work and where they're at independently with their executive function skills. But more often than not, I'm asking, when do we have free play? If it's not there, how do we add it to our child's daily, schedule. Basically, you got a scheduled free play sometimes. But then also, how do we kind of scaffold and facilitate that free play? It really does. I mean, it changes I know you like science. It changes the neurons in their brains and their prefrontal cortex during childhood. It's really prepping their brain to regulate their emotions, to make plans and solve problems.
I have to say, I have seen so much growth. I'm going to get really teary eyed right now in all three of my children, just like in the last 2 weeks. And we spent the last 4 days, it was a longer holiday weekend. And they were just coming up with their own games, like left, right, and center. And I watched my daughter, who has a little bit more difficulty with executive function skills. And she came up with the rules of the game. She narrated the rules of the game. She answered questions about it. They were like, my son introduced a new rule. She was cognitively flexible. Like, I just watched all these things happening in real time and recognized, like, how much growth was happening just in this moment of play. Like, I was sitting there as a parent. I'm like outside the pool in my glasses crying. And I'm just like, absorbing the beauty of this moment. But like, I've truly seen play just unlock a child's potential. And how it was facilitating.
It's so bumpy. Like, I think the thing is too, is that it doesn't always look pretty and joyful, right? Like, sometimes that
play. No, there have been a lot of misses along the way.
They're like arguing with each other. They're maybe like unhappy with what maybe the family decided to do that day. But within all of those moments and experiences, they're learning to self-regulate. They're learning to problem solve. They're learning to, perspective taking doesn't happen later on. But in a lot of ways, we're sort of modeling perspective taking for kids. And those are all executive function skills that, I touch upon with the families that I work with. So, that's like a success story right there. Just,
we've had a lot of bumps. We will continue to have a lot of bumps. They are siblings. There are moments of friction and all those things, but yeah, it was like one of these moments where I was like, wow, like I see what is happening before my eyes. And like all the steps that were needed in order to facilitate what was happening. I think by default also in kind of the society we are in, they're going to ask and, naturally ask for the parent to kind of intervene at different moments. And, I'll kind of throw it back to them sometimes and be like, well, what do you guys think? Why don't you guys talk about it? It seems like she's feeling X, and kind of putting the onus back on them to figure out, obviously, if something's unsafe or, that's a different story. But really trying to remove myself as much as possible. And again, that's a muscle that like I have to keep working on because it's not innate to me.
It's building a little like frustration tolerance, I think, for us. And when we see our kids struggle, I think our natural instinct is to kind of swoop in and rescue or teach in that moment. But in a lot of cases, it's the best teachable moment to sort of watch them work through it and experience that frustration a little bit, because when we shield kids from that, then they sort of don't get that. It's harder for them to develop that ability to sort of problem solve later on because, they're kind of used to someone else sort of, taking the lead on that. And we want them to feel capable and empowered and they want to feel capable also.
Right. Totally. All right. Switching gears a little bit. So you do come from a very strong foundation and background in literacy. Do you mind kind of touching upon, I think this is one of the things, I have kids who are a little bit older where you're kind of nervous that they might regress in terms of reading and, as an expert within this domain, kind of what is your advice to parents who, want to make sure that they're doing the best for their children in kind of this regard? I just think like I always thought of like, the reading list and all these other things. Like, what is your advice as it relates to kind of this realm for parents?
To start, take a deep breath. There's so much pressure and a lot of fear around the summer slide. And we like feel that from the schools because like you said, their kids are given summer packets and these lofty reading lists and maybe even big workbooks. But I just say like take a deep breath, because I think in a lot of ways, curriculum has raised its expectations to meet state demands. I'd even argue that it's not always developmentally appropriate. So, like,
we're going to have a whole nother talk on how broken our educational system is.
Yeah. So to me, sometimes that external pressure to, like, make literacy and work happen over the summer does not match what I think the summer is intended to be for kids. Uh-huh. Of course, there are some kids, especially those with, like, a reading disability, who really do need repetition and consistency to keep up, you know, the momentum and progress. But and a good tutor will ensure that's engaging if that's the scenario that a family is sort of managing. But I think this is a big topic that we could, like, really, really jump into. My biggest recommendation, honestly, would be to use the world around you as much as possible. Like, buy less, just use what you have, and read in some way. And I think audiobooks count. Every single day. So I would say, like, some examples of this is, like, you know, if you're about to write out a grocery list, like, maybe you can equip one of your kids to kind of help you dictate that, right? And even, like, for the littles, like, my five-year-old, she can't write, but she'll sit there and I'll say, oh, we need strawberries on our grocery list, and she'll, you know, draw a strawberry. You know, and it doesn't have to be the exact list that you're following, but for them to sort of engage in how we use literacy on our day to day, is, to me, it's kind of taking the pressure away from it a little bit.
Yeah.
Things like, I play little games, maybe, where it's like, I focus on, like, one letter of the week with my daughter, and we're like, oh, today's the letter S week. And, you know, what around the room may start with the S, but I'm not buying cards. I'm not buying packets of things. I'm not buying books that are, like, workbooks that are focused on her writing the letter S 20 times. School's for that, right? School will teach my kids how to read. I'm a literacy specialist. I'm not going to be teaching my daughter so much how to read. I want her to engage in literacy in our home. I think sort of we kind of can help equip it and learn to love it. So we'll look for, you know, when we're grocery shopping, if we're focusing on the letter S, we'll be like, where can we find the letter S? And there's the big signs. For older kids, it may take a little bit more creativity. I think it's really great to help foster, like, what their interests are and giving them the resources for that. So, you know, I would say, like, giving them opportunity to, like, get magazines of things that they like to read about, or modeling reading is so important, in my opinion. We want our kids to engage in reading every day. Well, we should be doing the same thing. And I know it's easy to kind of say, like, oh, well, I read the news on my phone, but we really want to show kids and model kids the importance of using the world of literacy around them.
I'm just gonna say,
I did this summer, just as another example. The classroom teacher and me, and anybody could do this, though, was, you know, labeling her dresser. So she, you know, I kind of am thinking about, like, kind of giving her some jobs and some chores around the house. And one of the things would be to put away her clothes. So, you know, I'm thinking, like, she's learning to be reading in the next, like, year or so. So we decided to label her clothes, and she sort of helped me on the computer. We said, what does the word start with? I wrote it out for her. We did a picture of a shirt, and then we just kind of pasted it right on the side of her.
I just did this with my son, too.
Those who don't know, it was his favorite activity, and he was so proud, and he called everybody in to see it, too.
Yeah, and so just, I mean, label things in your house. Make it kind of silly. Go on a word hunt somewhere and maybe hide words around the house with, like, post-it notes. But, you know, to me, again, I'm all about keeping it simple and just bringing it into the world that we're, you know, living in.
I'm gonna give a twofer right now, because based on two of the strategies you already gave us. So I had not been reading recently, and, like, it was just I was overwhelmed by a lot of different things, you know, in life. And I am a voracious reader, and I missed reading. And a lovely friend of mine got me a bunch of books for my birthday. And I've been very active about reading it when I'm around my children. So, like, one, I now seem occupied and busy. So they're, you know, making themselves busy with something else. And I had it outside with me and I read two books this weekend. So I got through two whole books. How wonderful for me. And my kids were engaged in active play and they were seeing me being excited about a book that I was reading and not wanting to put it down. And it was funny, the last few nights, like all three of my children independently were like, can you read me a book tonight? Or could we read together? Or can we take turns or whatever? You know, like just even seeing the shift for them. And I was like, oh, wow. Like that was literally the only thing that had changed, you know, in our day as it related to books or anything like that. It wasn't like I had restaged it. It wasn't like I brought in new books or anything else. The only thing that really changed within that domain was just me reading. And it kind of like re-excited them about it. And my son came and curled up with a book next to me, you know, because he wanted to then, you know, participate with me in reading. And so it was really sweet. So I can say
that's a strategy you can like echo for a lot of things. I call that body doubling when I'm working with my families and students. We can even think about like a middle school and high school student who may have a summer reading list. Typically, most schools will ask that all kids in a certain grade read like one or two books over the summer. And so when you're engaging in the reading, you know, you can slightly gently nudge and say, this would be a great time for you to be reading. Another thing that I just love recommending so much is that, and this is for those who have the older kids, but maybe I guess some elementary schools might have specific books for kids to read, but letting those school chosen books be sort of like a family book club. I think it's really fun when it's not just our middle schooler reading this book for school, but have mom and dad read it and have everyone talk about it, whether we're listening to it all together as an audiobook while we're driving in the car or going on vacation. But I, you know, I had a family who told me that they took that suggestion and the books were so good. And he had a little sister and he kept, you know, she kept asking for like the update after like every night that everyone would be reading. So in the morning at breakfast, which is the only time that they were all together, she would be like, okay, what happened in like the last three chapters last night? And she was just as engaged, and she's not at a reading age yet, but she was just as engaged in the story. And now this middle schooler is not just learning to enjoy reading and seeing his family enjoy reading with him, but then he's also learning the skills of storytelling, summarizing, really kind of having a purpose to that reading rather than it just feeling like a chore. And I think that's just a really cool way to like bring literacy into the household, even with, you know, parents who have older students too.
I love that. All right, switching gears again, because I gotta extract as much information on as many topics as I possibly can for, you know, for everybody who's listening. So summertime tends to be a time when families do take, you know, potentially a vacation.
Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about some of the, you know, one, either potential challenges or struggles or ways to kind of prepare for it, as well as kind of some of the benefits or strengths or things that positive outcomes that can come from travel kind of as a whole, as it relates to children?
Yeah. And this is coming at great timing because we actually just took our first like family of four vacation together. So, I've learned a lot. I think my biggest...
Talk about learning for kids. There's a lot of learning for grownups, too.
There's a lot of learning. I think actually more learning for grownups here, to be quite honest.
Yeah.
My biggest piece of advice is really know your kids. Like, learn who they are and be really attuned to their needs and plan accordingly to that rather than our expectations. You know, I think I kind of went in with this like grand, like, we're going to create memories. We're going to go to this water park and then we're going to go to the beach and then we're going to go here. But I think we often forget that as fun as these things are and our kids are having a blast, they can also be incredibly overwhelming. And when we travel, you know, we're off schedule, our feeding schedules are off, our sleeping may not be as great as it typically is because it's a new environment. And so I think kind of like lowering the expectations to, make sure that like, you know, if our kid is kind of struggling at the beach, like, cause it's hot and they maybe like aren't eating so well, that it's totally okay to be adjusting your agenda or your plans for the day to say, you know what, they kind of really just need like a break from the sun and we're going to head back. And we were supposed to go to a park later, but knowing my kid right now, that might be a total disaster. Because I think, you know, in a lot of cases, I've just also seen and I've felt myself almost going there being frustrated, like, we're at the beach, you're supposed to be having fun, or we're on vacation, you're supposed to be having fun. Like, why aren't you having fun? But like, you know, they're not going to, in a lot of ways, in many cases, I mean, they're not going to say to us, Mom, I feel overwhelmed and I didn't eat well today. We're going to really kind of feel that more in their break down their emotions. And so, you know, kind of planning for that, just knowing who our kids are, what kind of, you know, makes them sort of off balance in a way.
Yeah.
And then I think another thing you and I talked about, which I love, is sort of like this thing that a term I've heard is the emotional vaccination. It's basically verbalizing what we might anticipate would be hard for them and then brainstorming ahead of time on ways that they could handle it. So for example, like on the way to like in the car on the way to like a theme park or something, you know, this can sound a little bit like, oh, I'm so excited for the rides today. That's like really, really fun. You know, there's usually a lot of people there and it can be really hot and we have to wait a long time sometimes for our turns. And that can be really, really tricky. So how can we handle this? And giving kind of like, I guess it's like that, like I said, the emotional vaccination, it's like presenting what might be challenging ahead of time, but giving them some tools and advocacy to say like, oh, well, you know, you'd be surprised what they come up with. But sometimes it's like, oh, well, I just need my drink of water. It's like, oh, right. Okay, like, what could you say to mommy if you're starting to feel a little bit overwhelmed or if you're feeling tired? Okay. You know, and you kind of plan ahead of what could be difficult. And it doesn't mean that it's going to eliminate all the difficult things that happen, but it almost gives them, you know, just the skills to be ready for those tough moments.
I love that. And I think, you know, it's the previewing for them. It's involving them in being the problem solver for whatever may come up. And, you know, it was funny when I first heard that term, I like, you know, it made sense afterwards when we were talking about it and explaining it. But it really is. It's like they're getting a little bit of exposure to it. So then when something, you know, when the actual impact happens, they're more prepared for it. Their body's more prepared for it. They're mentally more prepared for it. They're physically more prepared for it. They're, you know, like all those different things with it. And, you know, I've shared, I have neurodivergent children, and something that we do, which, you know, I know many other families kind of similarly do, is actually construct like an entire social story around it, you know? So for something that is, and it's something that feels, I actually have one, I'll pick it. So when people, you know, when we go away, I always create kind of a,
we went away, so the Podell family.
Oh my God, I love this.
I literally have it for every trip we've ever taken. Anytime we're doing something that feels like very much out of the realm of kind of normalcy and typical and kind of routine for us, is it's an opportunity to preview it. And in the social story, we'll map out, like, again, we're going to the airport. There might be really long lines. There might be a lot of people. This is what it looks like to go through security. And then when we get to the gate, it might, you know, it might be really loud with the intercom. And, you know, and then coming up also, again, like you described, kind of with the strategies and discussing it, we'll discuss it in advance. So we, you know, we'll collectively come up with a, when the intercom gets too loud, what's something that we can do? And it's like, oh, well, we can walk away and we can go to the bathroom where it's a little quieter, or we can go and put on our, you know, noise canceling headphones, or whatever it might be, and kind of doing it and then working it into the story as well. And that's something that we have found really helpful. But I think a lot of it too is like, I think we often forget, like sometimes we'll remember it is challenging for the child. Sometimes we forget it is challenging for the adult. So it's also, you know, lowering your own expectations, knowing that certain things may not go exactly right. But like, I know for myself, when I'm traveling, I don't eat as well. I don't sleep as well. You know, like all those different elements are happening to me too. And I'm in, you know, I have better tools to equip myself for handling it, but like, it's dysregulating for me too. And I'm not, you know, and I'm there and remembering that too, is helpful to kind of give myself grace in those moments of like, oh, I'm tired too, or oh, I wish this kind of went a little bit differently than, you know, more along the lines of what we anticipated. But I will say, having taken now several trips with my children,
regardless of whether it's not the memory that I expected or wanted or, you know, what envisioned, there's growth in every single trip. Like, and I, you know, and sometimes it's going forward to go back, backwards to go, but whatever it might be. But like, I have never come back from a trip and my kids didn't come back with new skills, feeling, you know, more independent, having greater autonomy, utilizing different skills in different ways. Like, it's just every single time I am amazed by it, no matter how, in my mind, how challenging the trip may have been or how exhausted it may have been. You know, like, of course, there are those joyous moments on the trip and, you know, I don't want to minimize those either. But regardless of how challenging it might feel in those moments, like, yeah, we may have had to leave the park earlier. We may have had to leave the zoo earlier or whatever it may have been. Kind of like in aggregate, there is growth. There is memories. There's beauty. There's like all these things. And my kids actually love it. Like, my kids ask for trips all the time. I'm like, yeah, no, we can't go on a trip every day. It's not how we're like, love that you love going. This is great. Like, we went from you being apprehensive and a little bit nervous and whatever it might be to like really wanting that. But I'm like, unfortunately, that's not really how it goes. But no, I love that idea of kind of like, one, not just the exposure, incorporating them into the planning of it and understanding of it, letting them being kind of the person who's coming up with, you know, the strategies that work for them. And like you said, sometimes it may be something as simple as I need a sip of water, you know, like, and I think we sometimes feel like it has to be, you know, a big, massive something, but like for them, it might be, you know, for one of my daughters, it's like, I can give her a bracelet, you know, a bracelet. She feels connected to me. She feels grounded. She knows that like, I'm there to support her, whatever it is. It's just like, she's like, I think we should bring some extra bracelets with us. And like, would that have been the first thing that jumped to mind to me? No, it would have been like, I need to make sure we have this next. We need to like, you know, like all the different things. And I was like, she just wanted to feel connected to me, you know, like, and that's what would be the most helpful. So anyway.
And about that too, is that, you know, I think when we bring them in also to like the planning of the day, like it really kind of empowers them to think about their needs too. I really encourage families of all ages, when we have that internal dialogue, actually like verbalize
it out loud.
I love because that helps develop this, what I call the internal dialogue or like the brain coach. That's an executive function skill where we're saying, okay, today we're going to the beach. What do we need to pack? I mean, we know what we need to pack, but when we engage our kids to say, what do I think I need? And, you know, then, you know, my child will be like, oh, a towel. Okay. Do we have our towels? Where's the bag? All of those things are part of the learning process that, you know, is kind of, like I said, low stakes, low pressure. And it allows for them to, you know, sort of see what goes into the planning of a vacation or the planning of your day and allows for those moments. I think if we sort of try to orchestrate everything on our own and then we go have fun, that's a lot of pressure on a kid to be like, especially if it's like a new environment and it's, and I know like my kid is very different. I have one that will just run into any new situation happy as can be, and another one who's an observer. And if I were to just say, go play and have fun, she would be like very put off by that, you yeah. know? So when we sort of verbalize what's happening in our own internal dialogue and bringing them into it, then again, it is emotionally vaccinating. Okay, I know what I'm going to expect for my day, even if we don't have a perfect schedule. But we can say, okay, we could go to the beach and then we'll see how we're feeling in the afternoon. Maybe we'll want some quiet time, or maybe we'll still feel like we have a lot of good energy. Maybe we had a good lunch and we would be totally up for going to the boardwalk later.
Right.
I think when we kind of bring them into like that internal dialogue that we have, it sort of gives them opportunity then to, you know, really enjoy the day.
Yeah, no, totally. And I will say one further is, for some of my kids, it's enough to just verbalize it. For one of my children, like, she really needs to visualize it. Like, she needs to, like, the words have to connect to the visualization of what's happening. So it was funny. We were going to the beach and I was like, okay, let's picture we're at the beach. What are we gonna, you know, like, and kind of walking through each of the steps. But the actual like creating the vision in her mind to something yeah. that is, you know, yeah. So
it's a wonderful strategy. It's amazing. You could kind of really apply that to anything, going to the park, driving to school, right? Like anything, not just vacations. That's amazing.
Yeah. Okay. So we're in summer. We maybe go on a vacation. I'm going to have to bring it up and maybe we could
you're like, up and at all.
I know it's coming.
Yes. Yes. If we could talk about screen time a little bit. So I kind of, again, I appreciate and respect your philosophy and I try to mimic it as best as I possibly can. But for those who are unaware, do you mind sharing kind of like, what is your kind of perception around screen time? What is your advice around it? Any suggestions for it? Because during summer, you know, it tends to creep in if we're not super cognizant about kind of what's happening. And again, any kind of strategies or thoughts or advice you have around that.
Yeah, it's a topic I'm actually pretty passionate about. And I know the reality of it. Like screen time is here in my home and I use it. I use it for my own survival. I use it because my kids enjoy it. I will say, you know, you'll never hear from me recommend like a phonics app or a math video game. Because to me, nothing really kind of matches the real life reading, the socialization, the hands-on learning. But I guess what I will say is that I don't think that all screens are created equal. So when I refer to screen time and to me, the really like a limit, like really taking screen time kind of like out of the daily expectation. When I say like screen time, I'm really kind of referring to like YouTube, video games, social media, right? TV, I totally think that it like has its place. We can really enjoy TV together with our kids. Sometimes it's a total necessity in some families' homes, especially for, you know, when there are parents who are juggling very busy schedules. You know, as long as it's intentional, I think like if we're choosing intentional TV shows that we make sure aren't overstimulating or exposing, you know, content that's not maybe appropriate for our kids, that's one thing. But when it comes to the other stuff, the other screen time, I'll get really sciencey and just share that. I think we've been a little tricked sometimes. Parents have been told that social media or screen time can be regulating. I think we have also been told that it could, there's like educational things that kids can learn from it. And I don't doubt that they can, but it can actually really do damage if it's taking up more of their time. Or to me, it's like, what is that screen time taking away? Is it taking away being outside time? Is it taking away free play? Because then if it does, then I have a problem with it. I have a big problem. And I really want parents to sort of revisit that. I mean, it really kind of, the way that it's designed, you know, the way that screen time is sort of made, it's like, you know, it really is designed to give kids such high levels of dopamine to keep them focused, to keep them hooked. And so with these young developing brains, they're sort of then being programmed to need these high levels of dopamine to be self-regulated, to be attending. So to me, the outcome, the impact of too much screen time that's not intentional, that's taking away time that could be free play or social, like real life socialization, there we need to make an adjustment there. And I know it's a tough cycle to break. I know that for some families, there is a lot of dysregulation around screen time. So I feel that. But, you know, I do kind of think that as parents, we want to make, sometimes we have to make hard decisions for our kids and, you know, basically take things away from them that they really enjoy because we know it's best for them. And I have a lot more to say about this, but I feel like you have always like so much good, like, you know, response to what I've shared so far.
Yeah, no, completely. And I, like you said, it's not easy. It's not something that is simple, notably in our society. And I think like, again, we had an influx of technology and screen time and all these things simultaneously with us moving away from kind of like the community model of like, you know, kids being able to just like run outside and play with their neighbors and all these other things. Like, there have been a lot of constraints that have shifted and changed and evolved over the years that have like kind of created this environment that makes it, has created this. But I do think, like, again, kind of the intentionality of what they are watching, like, we can help support that. We can put, you know, kind of parameters on the different devices that are going to kind of limit kind of the externalities of what they're able to get into. There are ways in which you can kind of lock them into certain programming, or, you know, again, design it so that there's more of the Daniel Tigers versus the, you know, again, going on social media or whatever, or the YouTube, you know, unboxing or whatever it might be. But I do think, like you said, it's, they're getting this high from it, and they're getting the kind of dopamine hit from watching all this, and then kind of the craving levels kind of rise for it. It's interesting when you say it that way. You know, it's like, would you give your child, you know, something that you know is not great for them in any other scenario? And the answer is, you know, likely no. So again, I am not minimizing the challenge. And in our house, we do have screen time. It's like you kind of described, you know, it is with intentionality. It is content that, you know, that I have screened, et cetera. And it's hard. It's really hard. But I do think, like you said, summer's a great time because we can get them outside. We can get them playing. Like, my kids, I know I can keep in a pool for the entire day, you know, so great. I will let them play in the pool for the entire, it was raining this weekend. They were in the pool. There was no thunder. It was raining. They got the rain, you know, a love of it, and being in the pool. Whereas, you know, other opportunities, it might not be, you know, as simple as that. But like during the summer, we really do try to get them engaged in kind of play as much as we possibly can as it works for me, you know, like as we're able to. And like you said, there are moments where that's not a possibility. And for other people, it's not a possibility in different scenarios, and being aware of that. And that every situation looks different, and that's also okay, you know, and understanding your child. So just questions that we ask at the end of each episode, because I always find it so kind of enlightening to hear what people were interested in themselves as a child. And I think that it's so indicative of like who we are. Like, it really shows kind of we are wired the way that we're wired. We all are kind of like, I even think of like things that I liked versus things my siblings liked, and who we wound up becoming and what we wound up doing. It's just like very funny when we look through the lens of toy. It was so predictive of what we wound up wanting to do and our passions and our interests and all those things. So with that, was there a favorite play activity that you had as a child? Was there something that you gravitated to all the time, and or that you were passionate about or brought joy to you?
You know, as a child, you know, I kind of grew up in the generation where where parents like did not engage in much play with us. And it was kind of like, you're outside all day long and I'll see you for dinner. So to me, I would always gravitate towards building for some reason. And my sister and I would build forts, and we would constantly modify the forts and, you know, bring our friends into the forts, and they would have to have like everything that needed to be there. So we would build, you know, we would try to build tables. I think it also helps that my dad was he built homes. So like we would maybe try to emulate that. I'm not sure exactly what it is, but I think just using nature as our basically the best toys that we could get our hands on. It kind of remains the same for my kids too. You will never come into my home that I try to, as much as possible, keep clean and not find some sort of sticks or rocks or something also in their play space. So to me, nature is their best playground, their best source for toys, per se.
Love that. So thank you. Thank you. Thank you again so much.
Thank you. This was so fun.
This was great, Maggie. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for listening. And of course, don't forget to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. And you can visit our sponsor, EduShape's website and social media pages for more insightful conversations on all things toys and child development. Thank you.